Welcome to This Is Money podcast, sponsored by Charles Stanley Direct. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Simon Lambert today is Ankara Carrick. And coming up, is this a week of history repeating itself? AI hype is causing a fresh wave of fears over a repeat of the dot-com boom and bust. Is the gold price warning us of an impending crash? Plus, has the regulator just fired the starting gun on PPI Mark II? Could you be in line for a £700 payday from the car finance scandal? Also today, we look at Conservative proposals to scrap stamp duty and why some people paid nothing for their energy last weekend. Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a message from our sponsors. Ever feel like you've got a money question but not sure where to get it answered? Well, now you do. Charles Stanley Direct's financial coaching service gives you one-to-one time with a real expert, someone who'll cut through the jargon and help you feel confident about your finances. And the best bit? You can start with a free 15-minute call. Just head to charles-stanley.co.uk/financial-coaching. Go on, your future self will thank you. Remember, investment involves risk. Right, back to the show. Welcome, Simon. Welcome, Ang. Now, the Bank of England has joined the growing chorus warning of the risk of an AI bubble, drawing comparisons to the dot-com mania 25 years ago. And we all know what happened there, don't we? The top five tech firms listed in the US now represent 30% of New York's S&P 500 index, the highest proportion in 50 years, while market data comparing earnings to prices were close to the lowest level in 25 years, comparable to the peak of the dot-com bubble. Meanwhile, veteran Citi commentator Alex Brummer, not mincing his words in his recent article, "The signs of a global financial crash," he says, "are everywhere. Gold's hit record prices. We'd be wise to prepare for catastrophe." Da da da! Simon. Not subtle there, is he, Alex Brummer? Are we headed for a crash? What's the deal with AI and the warnings from the Bank of England?
Right. So, to unpick this one, how have we gone from AI being the key to our bright future to the thing that's going to cause a financial crash in a few short months? That is the question possibly many people are asking themselves. Up until now, we've worried about AI taking our jobs, taking over the world, causing a Terminator-style apocalypse. Those minor issues, but crashing the stock market and then causing a financial crisis hasn't been at the top of people's AI worries. In fact, the stock market is absolutely raging off the back of people buying into the AI hype. What's happened is we are now being warned that there is a bubble, and that there is a bubble that is potentially set to burst and could burst in a quite spectacular way. What you have to detach from this is the technology and the financial stuff. So technologically, AI probably going to prove to be useful, probably going to prove to be a technology that is here to stay. You could say the same about the internet, which was responsible for the dot-com boom. Railways. I mean, as much as we get annoyed by delays, trains are pretty useful, and they were definitely a technology that stuck around. However, we also had a railway boom and bust. So just because something works and is actually useful and is going to stick around and could, in fact, trigger, you know, another form of sort of shift in how we live, industrial revolution, all of those things, does not mean that it cannot be responsible for a bubble that goes pop. And what's going on with AI is that there are a number of red flags. So just to cover off some of those red flags, the sheer concentration of investor interest in AI influenced stuff or AI influenced stories. If you cast your mind back as far as March, which wasn't actually that long ago, and remember Donald Trump's tariffs, that had people seriously worried. It was catastrophic as far as investors were concerned. Markets were absolutely tanking. Now, it wasn't just the tariffs. It was also the thing of like, he's not going to back down. He backed down. The taco trade was on. Trump always chickens out. people bought back into markets. But the rebound since then has been absolutely astonishing. The S&P 500 has gone from looking like it was going to have a bad year with investors being worried to looking like it's going to have another double-digit good year. It's up about 14% this year, and it's up 35% from its April lows. This is being driven largely by the AI belief and the AI hype. What's also going on in terms of the red flags is there are a number of deals that have been announced that you just look at them, right? And however much the people do in the deals try to explain them, you can't get over the bit where it looks like I'm going to give you some money and then you're going to buy my stuff. To me, any deal that involves I'm going to give you some money, you're going to buy my stuff, this is going to be great for everyone, you always need to look at that a bit closely. It's a bit of a red flag. It's like those deals that CEOs do that mean that at some point in the future, the share price hits a certain amount and they make absolute squillions. Quite often, and not always, but probably in 90% of those occasions, something goes wrong and it's a red flag that something is going to go wrong in the future. So we've had OpenAI, and OpenAI sits at the middle of this. OpenAI is the ChatGPT maker. OpenAI, unlike big tech companies that we talk about generally, isn't making any money. It's losing money. It's having to basically keep going and raising money to keep spending. And it is spending vast amounts of money to desperately try to improve AI. It's locked in this race to try and create, you know, artificial general intelligence, where basically mm-hmm. computer can think for itself, can reason as well as a human. Nobody has stopped to question whether that is actually a good idea and whether we should be doing this. But, you know, we're on that path. And when we all end up in the Terminator, it's a bit. Terminator 2, I think, would be good because at least then we get Guns N' Roses. Right. But anyway, back to the point. So OpenAI has struck a number of deals, massive deals. So it struck this huge deal with Oracle, US tech company, that sent Oracle's shares rocketing. And Oracle then made Larry Ellison the second richest man in the world. It was a good deal for Larry Ellison. OpenAI also struck a deal with NVIDIA. NVIDIA, the world's largest company, the chip maker at NVIDIA, which has $4.5 trillion company. Again, maybe slight red flag there. Is going to invest $100 billion in OpenAI. And OpenAI is going to buy its chips. And NVIDIA might get a stake in OpenAI. And then OpenAI struck another deal that was announced this week with AMD, another chip maker this time around. Yeah. So it's not just striking just one chip maker, striking more than one. Tens of billions of chips that it's going to buy from AMD that could then see OpenAI take a 10% stake in AMD. So what's going on here?
Where's the regulator in all this, Simon? I thought there were sort of competition issues. No, is that not a problem? Or
the US is committed to being a global leader in AI, and it is a global leader in AI, and there is a concern over what's China doing, right?
Yeah.
So there is a headlong rush into this. OpenAI sits kind of at the center of this and is actively and deliberately trying to create a web of kind of influence, a web of these vendor financing style agreements, a web where basically everyone has a stake in OpenAI succeeding. It's quite a clever move when you think about it, because it's like, right, we've all got to work together on this, guys, because we're all now interdependent on each other. What's going on with this, though, is that there are a lot of this money is going into building these huge data centers in the US, often in the middle of nowhere. And these data centers are there for computer processing, because like the computer processing power required by, you know, this rush mm-hmm. for generative AI is phenomenal. We're talking the kind of power that, you know, people are saying you'd need a nuclear reactor to power one of these things, right? This is absolutely astonishing, right? When you think about it. And there's this building rush going into these places, right? I mean, appetites for power are measured in gigawatts, right? And the costs can run up to $50 billion per gigawatt. Now, the concern is that there is this gold rush going on with these data centers, and that actually these data centers, the end point of this is that nobody's actually quite sure there's the demand there for the AI itself. Like these large language models, these generative AI models, in terms of businesses actually using them, I read a statistic the other day that said only 15% of businesses have actually discovered that they were worth using, you know, that they were actually getting anything, you know, out of it, like it was increasing their profits. So there isn't necessarily the demand there. It's a kind of like, if we build it, they will come kind of scenario. And there is a great deal of concern about all of this stuff that's going on. How are we going to power these things, right? These data centers, because they're talking about, you know, actually just having to build the power there because the grid in the US, and the US is, you know, has got a lot more energy than the UK and generates a lot more energy than the UK, doesn't have enough energy to power this. There was all kinds of things going on. Then there's also...
We were worried about electric cars, weren't we, Simon? And if everyone drove an electric car, now this is another level of energy, isn't it?
Yeah, they're going to build it like mass. So they're building things in like middle of Texas, right? Where it's windy and it's sunny. So you can, it's all going to be renewable energy. That's the story that's being sold to people. Is that actually going to work? There's then also the question of whether these data centers, how long they're going to last? Because the companies are saying, well, they're going to last X amount of time, right? But the critics are saying, well, you know, NVIDIA is constantly releasing new chips and improved chips. And when it releases its next batch of chips, it's doing a yearly cycle, right? It releases its next batch of chips. Those ones that you've just spent an absolute fortune putting in that data center, that you've spent an absolute fortune building and you're spending an absolute fortune powering, are now outdated. And are they going to be good enough for where AI is going next and so on? So there's concerns that, you know, these things aren't even going to, you know, particularly last. There's been another couple of things going on, you know, that cause red flags. So I had a conversation with a fund manager yesterday, a guy called David Coombs, works for Rathbones. Now, David is he's a fund manager who doesn't have the traditional background of a fund manager. Now, he said that he thinks he's seeing red flags. He thinks that you've got stuff going on here, and this is the concern lots of people are flagging, similar to dot-com boom. And the dot-com boom was actually, it was more like the problem, there was this infrastructure boom, okay? It was laying all these cables, these fiber optic cables and everything, that basically, like, the technology wasn't there for yet. And then you also had, you know, the dot-com company, stick a dot-com after your name, share price goes up kind of thing. There was this huge bubble going on. There have been a number of people flagging concerns that it's similar to the dot-com boom. Another red flag actually that David raised was this Electronic Arts deal that's been done involving the Saudis, like leverage buyout, sovereign wealth, Donald Trump's son, you know, helping negotiate the deal, all that kind of stuff. And we were talking about this and I said, well, the other thing that this reminds me of as well is, you know, I wasn't working in financial journalism during the dot-com boom and bust, right? I was finishing university at that point, but I was working during the credit crunch. And this reminds me of the sort of spring and summer of 2007, just before the credit crunch hit. And this sort of scenario where you had some people saying, and there were people warning about the credit crunch, right? It's completely wrong to think that there weren't people warning about it. There were people going, this stuff doesn't look good. And then there was lots of people on the other side going, it's fine. You know, they're like, as long as the music's playing, we'll keep dancing kind of attitude. And you've got that going on at the moment. You know, you've got this thing that's theoretically good. Nobody quite understands. It's going to change everything. It's different this time. I mean, there have been a couple of people, including Jeff Bezos, who said it's the AI thing is different this time because it's a good bubble.
No.
I mean, a good bubble. A good bubble is like, it was the kind of like, well, we're building out the infrastructure. People will make losses. It always happens, but it's a good bubble because we're building out the infrastructure. But if the infrastructure is integral to the bubble that's happening, which is, you know, what's going on here with the data centers, then is that a good bubble? How do you define a good bubble? And even good bubbles, when they burst, have a habit of taking down people's investments. And the big problem here is that AI investment, a Harvard economist, Jason Furman, did some number crunching. He reckons that AI investment accounted for 92% of US GDP in the first half of 2025, right? You take out AI investment and the US economy does not look anywhere near as good as people think it looks, right? So it's not growing anywhere near as much. On top of that, you look at the stock market. The US stock market accounts for 60 to 70% of the global market now. It is, you know, it's very concentrated. The Magnificent Seven accounts for something like 36% of that market. And then, you know, underneath that, you've got a whole tier of stocks that have risen a lot off the back of kind of AI stuff. Stocks that aren't in the Magnificent Seven, but have risen a lot off the back of the AI stuff. And it has the ability that if it all comes crashing down, right, it will hit other stock markets. You know, it will hit the FTSE 100. The FTSE 100 is not an AI-driven stock market, okay? People have been complaining about our lack of tech for a long time. But the S&P 500 crashes, it will hit the FTSE 100. You've got concerns over corporate credit as well. The spread on bonds, for example, corporate bonds to US treasuries, which are considered relatively risk-free, to corporate bonds, which are risky, is narrowest for a long time. Even junk bonds are trading very, very close to US treasuries. There's worries over this kind of shadow banking system where, you know, it's not bonds and it's not banks lending money, it's investors lending money to companies and so on. There's been a thing going on with the US auto parts maker that's cropped up recently. All of these things together have got people worried.
How exposed are individual investors? And I'm thinking here, because a lot of people nowadays invest in sort of these global ETFs and will be thinking, well, it's global, it's around the world, I'm cushioned against, you know, any big drop. Is that right?
The problem with a global tracker fund and a global ETF is essentially that fund keeps buying the companies that are doing best. They get bigger in the stock market as a bigger proportion of the stock market as their share price rises and as their value rises. And because the ETF is meant to track the market and it holds all the stocks in that market, then it buys more of the stuff that's bigger in there. So it gets referred to as the ultimate momentum trade. And the problem with momentum trades is that a momentum trade is you're buying the stuff that's going up. Momentum trades can unwind really quite quickly and you can see really quite big falls. You could say, you know, perhaps the market will rebound. And actually, we have seen recently, every time the market has taken a tumble, whether it's a correction or a crash, as it did in COVID, it's rebounded incredibly quickly. You know, COVID, considering the size of the fall and what was going on, market rebounded really quickly. The tariff correction earlier this year, market rebounded really quickly. The worry is you look back to things like dot-com boom and many of those biggest companies are still around, but it took them years, decades even for their share price to get back to where it was. It took a really long time for markets, some markets to get back to where they were. I mean, you could argue that in this case, maybe it is different this time. Information moves faster. You've got social media, you've got internet news, you've got all that kind of stuff. And it's like, you know, maybe stuff just does move quicker. Maybe markets do recover faster. But the difficulty is that, like, you know, when the market starts selling, and if people start pulling money out of those ETFs and out of those tracker funds, then those funds are then going to have to sell the assets that they hold as well. And you could have the reverse problem to what you have now when the funds are having to buy into companies that are going up.
The key litmus test, Simon, as to whether we will have a crash. No, I'll chat with Ang in a sec. Thank you for being patient, Ang. Have you changed any of your investments, Simon?
No, but I have thought about it, which is almost as good, isn't it? My ISA is not that exposed to the US, right?
And all right.
S&P 500. It's got a lot. It's got lots of emerging markets. It's got some Japan. It's got quite a lot of UK in it, which, as I have said before on this podcast, I don't want to know how much money I've lost over the last 15 years by being contrarian and saying the US is too expensive, the US is too expensive, because the US has been the only party to be at in town. And I would be on paper a much richer person if I hadn't have made those decisions to try and beat the market. And that's the problem. You try and make a decision to, you know, beat the market and you risk getting it wrong. My work pension is probably way more exposed due to the fact that most of it is in a global track fund. And that's what I did think about. Oh, well, maybe I should just do a bit of that. I mean, I don't know. It's difficult to know what to do. Do I want to go to bonds? Not sure I do want to go to bonds. Do you want to shift the kind of focus of the shares? You know, the UK market doesn't necessarily have the same AI hype driven problem. Mm-hmm. As I said, companies is relatively cheap. It's been doing better recently. Maybe it'd be good to shift a little bit more towards that. But as I said, every decision you make to do this, and if you're a long-term investor, you can probably ride this stuff out anyway. So a pension is a very long-term investment. But I have thought about it.
I did, Simon. So I have a bit of a percentage of my portfolio for sort of educational purposes, I like to put it. So I did recently invest in a couple of AI stocks and they went up so high. I think one doubled and one was up 50% that I thought, if that's not a big red flag that something, mind you saying that now, I'll probably double again. But, you know, I thought I'll happily take my winnings. I mean, it's over 3 months. It was such a short amount of time as well. I felt like a trader. But I thought, no, I'm going to take my winnings and toodle off into the sunset with that one. I wonder if other people will think the same. Ang, I have to ask about Alex Brummer's column piece. He mentions gold. Gold hitting record prices above $4,000. I think it dipped back down a little bit, but it's still hovering around that at the moment, isn't it? What does that tell us? Well, he says we'd be wise to prepare for catastrophe. Maybe.
Yeah, it's not a great sign, it reaching its kind of record level. And to go back to what Simon said, I'm heavily invested in the US. I don't want to check my portfolio just because I think I will get overexcited. But actually, gold is something that I have been looking at. I think it's not a great sign because it's obviously seen as a bit of a safe haven in sort of times of turmoil. So I think people piling into it suggests that, you know, they want something that's steady. I'd be interested to see, you know, with this AI bubble happening, whether we start to see, you know, funds looking at buying up more gold. If we see the kind of 60% equities, 40% bonds split changing, you know, we might see 50, 30, 20 or 60, 20, 20. And I do wonder if gold kind of becomes something that people look at. But it's not, I don't think it's a great sign. It's also probably not a great idea to buy at the top. But
yeah,
it could also go even higher. I mean, I think there was one of the big investment banks that it could reach 5,000 at some point. So yeah, I mean, it depends, you know, where you are in your investment journey as well. If you're nearing retirement, it could be quite a good way to protect yourself, you know, with more uncertainty in the Middle East, inflation, that sort of thing. But I think general consensus is it's good as part of a sort of diversified portfolio, not just buy loads of gold and hope for the best.
I mean, it's been an interesting one, hasn't it, Simon? I think Ray Dalio, the veteran American investor, saying that you should hold about 15% in your portfolio, which is rather a large amount, it seems. But we've seen central banks buy it up for over the last few years, from normal investors all the way to institutional investors as well. And it's the way that it's the purpose of gold, because it doesn't provide an income, does it? It's sort of that, what I hear it described as, an umbrella that you carry in your portfolio bag should you need it for when markets drop. A bit of security. Is that correct?
Yes. And arguably the best time to buy gold as a security umbrella would have been 2,000 years ago. And if you've done that, you've done very nicely indeed. Or last year, for example, would also have been equally, a good idea. Buying it now at its peak, obviously, if you buy anything at its peak, you are working on the basis that other people are going to keep buying it and make it go up. Right? And you don't want to be the last person who thinks that. Because the last person who thinks that is the person who buys at the absolute peak and then sees it fall. Gold is a sentiment-driven investment. It doesn't do anything, right? You can't earn an income from it. It can't make you a profit. It can't do anything like that. You can make some jewelry out of it. It has some industrial uses. And it is a long-term store of value. That has been proven, as evidenced by my joke about the best time to buy it would have been 2,000 years ago. Right. And in that sense, it has proven its mettle, no pun intended, in a way that Bitcoin has not. because you couldn't buy Bitcoin 2,000 years ago. It's not Bitcoin's fault. Okay, you just couldn't buy it 2,000 years ago, right? Couldn't buy it 20 years ago either. We've had this conversation before. You've asked me if Bitcoin is a new gold, and I have used exactly the same line, but in reverse. Ask me in 2,000 years' time. This is your early sort of nod that we will be doing the 2011 year celebration of the podcast in 2,000 years' time, and inviting you to email in for tickets.
Might be. AI would be having our voices over, you know, it could be. Don't joke, Simon.
Yeah, it'd be like ABBA Voyage, but better, because it doesn't have any ABBA songs in it. My point is, 15% is punchy, but you might think if gold is going to keep going up and that you're unlikely to be the last person who's going to think it's going to keep going up. I don't think that somebody who buys gold now is going to be the last person to think it's going to keep going up, right? Okay, I think it is going to keep going up, but the opportunity for that is limited. You know, there's a lot of fear around at the moment. You know, this kind of FOMO fear, isn't there? So, in fact, it got referred to as the FOMO gold rally. Things could change around, you know. This is the problem with the AI bubble stuff. It's like you can shift your investments, but you could be too soon. Bubbles have a habit of like running for quite a while. It could be another year to run on this thing, right? You could miss out on 20% returns, 30% returns, or you could actually be right. It could be good news. Now, to go back to that conversation with David that I had yesterday, he's a multi-asset manager and he has shifted the makeup of his funds. The more cautious ones he's shifted them more, the more adventurous ones he's shifted them less. And he has shifted away from, you know, Magnificent Seven, US tech. He has dialed down the equities. He's bought more, he's not buying corporate bonds, but he has bought government bonds. And he's holding some more cash. That is the other option you can do, is you can hold some more cash, because if you've got cash, right, when the market does slump, you can buy in. And often, I always thought this is a great line. This is something that Henry Pryor, the buying agent, always says about buying properties, is you make the money when you buy, not when you sell. It's like if the market falls 30% and you can then buy in, then you're probably going to do pretty well off that in the future, right? Because, like, you know, 30% is 30, 40% is like almost always maximum fall kind of thing. The super crash, it'll be more, but you know, then you get the rebound and you've bought in cheap. Bonds is an interesting one, because also people are worried about the bond market. Yields on UK government bonds, for example, are pretty high because people are worried about the UK's finances. Yields on US bonds aren't as high, but people are still quite concerned about the US finances. France, its finances don't look amazing. You know, most rich countries' bonds, you are saying, okay, well, I'm just going to hold my nose about the state of their finances. But if something bad does happen, if there is a crash, if there is, you know, financial apocalypse, okay, I'm not predicting financial apocalypse here, I'm just giving examples of things, then you're going to see a scenario where central banks are going to have to cut interest rates. And that is going to see bond prices, which move in the opposite direction to yields or the interest rates on bonds, go up. So all those bonds that have been issued now at higher interest rates are going to look more attractive if central banks are forced to cut interest rates. At the moment, people are saying, I don't want those bonds. I want bonds with higher interest rates. They're demanding higher interest rates. But that could flip around, and you could find that bonds do create the kind of ballast in people's portfolios.
And just a quick one. Crashes, well, they don't sound great. Is there anything that just we can do for our everyday finances to prepare?
No, they're not great. I think one of the worrying things that I've noticed more and more is people referring to things as, you know, the lowest since 2009, which is not great to hear, because we definitely don't want a rerun of that. But I think there are some obvious things you can do. I mean, as Simon says, when it comes to investments, a lot of those trackers are market value weighted rather than equal weighted. So it could be worth looking to see if you can swap some of those. The main one that when I speak to people about this is don't panic, which is easier said than done. But I think the main point is don't pull out all of your money. We're not quite at that stage yet. It's hard to predict when we will get to that point. But there are some basic things, you know, budgeting, making sure you have a kind of financial buffer. So looking at your savings, if you can put more into, you know, your rainy day fund, then that's great. And also making sure that they've got, you know, you're earning, you're beating inflation with that. So Chase is paying a decent rate on their easy access. There are some good deals to be had there. And then elsewhere, I think with mortgages, if you've got a fixed deal coming to an end, and I think there will be millions sort of coming to the end of this year or next, you can secure a rate, you know, up to 6 months before it ends. So you can move on to one. And then if, you know, if interest rates are cut and then we see mortgage rates being cut as a result, then you can then move on to a better rate if they do emerge. And then finally, pensions, as we've spoken about, it obviously depends where you are. If you're close to retirement, it's obviously going to be a bit more worrying. But I think experts generally say it's best to probably dial back withdrawals from your pot for now. And it might be worth moving a portion into cash or bonds or something less risky.
All right, then. We'll leave that to one side. I'm sure it will come up again. But another return to the past moment this week, and that came in the form of the car finance saga. The city watchdog released details of a compensation scheme which could see millions get hundreds of pounds in payouts. Is it fair compensation for bad practices, Simon Lambert? Or is it PPI all over again, of which I got nothing? Simon, if you would, because I know that you came out rather speedily with this story when it broke on Tuesday, was it? Remind us of the car finance scandal. And what's the latest?
Right. It's not the new PPI. That's what you need to know. It's not going to be as big as PPI. There were concerns that it was going to be as big as PPI. And they have been
just a one-liner on the PPI.
Right. PPI, payment protection insurance. Payment protection insurance was a product that was sold by banks alongside loans, credit cards, and even mortgages, mortgage payment protection insurance. Often they didn't tell people how much it was going to cost them. Often it was sold to people who weren't going to be able to claim on it anyway, because they were excluded in some way, most obviously the self-employed, but also lots of other people. Often people weren't even being told that they were sold it. Often there was people who had it added to their loan, which it bumped up the cost from, and the person selling them the loan got lots of commission and potentially a bonus off the back of selling enough PPI, and banks made tons of money out of it, and people didn't even know they had PPI. This was first flagged as a problem in the early 2000s. By the time I started at This Is Money at the end of October 2005, okay, right, the eagle-eyed or the eagle-eared, so to speak, will notice that's nearly 20 years ago. We were already writing about PPI being a ripoff and banks scamming people and telling, and then soon after that, we were writing about how to like get it back. But the banks continued to sell PPI on an industrial scale. It should be said, for a good few years after that. Then there was the sort of court cases that meant that people could reclaim their PPI, and it cost the banks an absolute fortune. I think it was something like 50 billion or something like that. It was a lot of money, right? Okay. And in a sense, you know, it helped to boost the economy because people were given money for PPI, which they went out and spent. Interestingly, they reckon quite a lot of that money went into putting down deposits on buying cars, which were bought on finance agreements, usually PCP deals, personal contract purchase deals, or sometimes hire purchase, but PCPs are cheaper. You put down a deposit, you pay a monthly amount for a set period of time, for example, 3 years. Then you have the option to either pay a balloon payment at the end, which gives you ownership of the car, or you hand the car back. And then put down a deposit and start again. This is how most new cars are bought in this country and has been for quite some time. And there was a big boom in this industry, some of it fueled by people using their PPI payments to buy said cars. Effectively, you're just basically funding the depreciation over a three-year period. Many of those people were buying those cars from car dealers who were arranging the finance for them. Now, potential red flag: car dealer, finance, arranging it for you. I don't know. You know, you might think, as a court recently found, that you wouldn't expect the car dealer to be acting for your benefit. But people didn't really question this. And some of the car dealers were indulged in a practice where they could basically bump up the rate on the loans in order to get more commission, known as a discretionary commission arrangement. Also, there were some absolutely humongous commissions being paid, and also people who didn't have commissions disclosed themselves. Unsurprisingly, this blew back up in the faces of the car finance companies and the banks and the car dealers who were indulging in this stuff. There was a court case in August, the Supreme Court, which followed on from earlier court cases. And the Supreme Court found that basically it wasn't enough to just not be aware that there was commission for you to have been missold, right? And for you to claim money back. But it did say, it identified these discretionary commission arrangements as a problem and said that some of those people should be able to claim money back. The FCA had been looking at these discretionary commission arrangements, immediately came out. This was announced on a Friday after the market closed because it was considered so market sensitive that, you know, it could really sink bank share prices. The FCA had the weekend to come up with what it was going to do, announced on the Sunday night that it was going to have a consultation on a redress scheme for people to have compensation. That was what was announced this week, the consultation on that. The upshot of this is that millions of motorists who took out car loans from dealerships are in line for compensation worth an average £700. If you took out a car loan from dealership between 6th of April 2007 and 1st of November 2024, you could be covered. The FCA estimates that 44% of cases where people bought cars on finance over that period, there could be a payout. If 85% of those people claim, it will cost something like £8 billion to the banking industry. On average, people will get a payout of about £700. Obviously, that depends on the amount of commission, the loan that you took out and everything like that. Now, there's some people who might get more than one of these because we're talking here about a period that covers, you know, 2007 to 2024. And many people were on a kind of like 3-year cycle with these cars. So you could find people who had three or even five of these and got mugged off five times by dealers over that period. And the FCA is basically announced this consultation into the scheme, announced this consultation into the compensation. It has produced a template complaint letter to give to your motor finance provider, which you can find on the FCA website. The provider must then respond, explaining details of any commission arrangement, if it was a DCA, or commission accounted for at least 35% of the cost of credit, which is another one of the benchmarks the FCA has put in, or there was a contractual tie between the lender and the broker. And if one of those is in place, you could get compensation. What you shouldn't do is use a claims company, though. Mm-hmm. Claims companies are absolutely bombarding people with messages about that. There's adverts all over the place, on the radio, on the internet, but don't use the claims company. Use the FCA's letter that he has got there and do it yourself. People are going to start getting their money probably from the end of next year. People who've already put in complaints are going to be at the front of the queue. But if you think that this affects you, go to thisismoney.co.uk/cars. You can find our guide that explains a lot more.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Lisa Kaplan for our weekly Investing Explained feature. Lisa, got a question here for you from a listener. Can a stocks and shares or cash ISA be inherited and keep its tax-free wrapper, or is that lost at death?
We have to distinguish between where a spouse or a civil partner inherits and where it's anybody else. Where a spouse or civil partner inherits, essentially they inherit that ISA allowance. There's some little technical bits about that, but that's what it comes down to. They inherit enough ISA allowance to cover the value of the money that's in an ISA, so it all passes very nicely and tax efficiently. Where it's somebody else, the ISA status isn't lost on death. It stays for a while, sort of waiting until the money is sorted out. And when the money is sorted out, that's when the ISA status is lost. So that's going to happen whether the assets are distributed.
if the ISA account is closed, it'll lose the ISA status. And there's also a time limit of, I think, 3 years on that. It's really helpful because, of course, we know there's no capital gains on death. But if between death and the assets being distributed, there can be capital gains and also there can be income, which doesn't apply in an ISA. So that's quite useful.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Welcome back. Could stamp duty be scrapped? That's what Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch wants to do. In her speech to the party conference this week, she promised the Tories would get rid of the bad tax in order to improve social mobility. Now, economists say stamp duty, which can run into tens of thousands of pounds, hampers the housing market and the economy as it discourages people moving. Ang! Firstly, stamp duty. How does it work? Why has it become so toxic?
So stamp duty is what you pay when you buy property. So it's only paid over if the property is worth over 125 grand or 300 grand if you're a first-time buyer. I mean, what has been quite a fairly lackluster conference season, this lots of people got very excited about Kemi Badenoch's announcement because it's become such a hated tax. I mean, probably as hated as inheritance tax, because it just adds on thousands and thousands to how much you pay in what is already an expensive thing to buy a house. And the argument is that stamp duty prevents people from moving or downsizing. So you've got a situation where people are sat in huge homes. It's too expensive to move because they may want to move to a bungalow, Lee Boyce's favorite thing to talk about, but they can't because it's going to cost them, it's 5% up to 925 grand and then 10% to 1.5 million, then 12%. So it is a lot of money. So we've kind of got a situation where we've got kind of dwindling housing stock for first-time buyers or young families who, you know, want to move, but we've got older people maybe sat in big homes because it's too expensive. So I think the argument is that if we scrap stamp duty, it becomes less expensive to move. It's great for first-time buyers, but there is a risk that it then pushes property prices up like it did before when we had a stamp duty holiday. And it's also, it's not a cheap policy. I think the OBR expects it to bring in 10 billion, but then that doubles to, you know, over 20 billion by 2030. So that's a pretty big black hole to fill.
Yeah, it's just one of those things, isn't it, though, that it's sort of short-term pain could equal long-term gain. And wasn't one of the issues with the stamp duty holiday was the fact that everyone was trying to buy in that short about time. And it was that sort of window that was causing the problem, not necessarily getting rid of stamp duty. So if we got rid of it altogether, then it might not have the same impact, or got it back down to, what was it, 1% when it was under Gordon Brown, or he was the one that started to change that. Is that fair?
Kemi Badenoch, I take my hat off to her on this one, because when I saw this, I was like, oh, thank God, like someone, like some common sense for once on a tax. I'm not a massive Kemi Badenoch fan, but the stamp duty thing, it's like, it's a terrible tax. And it's a tax that has got worse and worse over the years. Every time a chancellor has meddled with it, and my God, have chancellors meddled with this tax. And yeah, it's like, well, we can't afford it now. It's £9 billion a year. Well, until 1997, when Gordon Brown started meddling with it, we got on perfectly fine with stamp duty being a flat 1% above £60,000. Mm. And you could buy a lot more house for £60,000 in 1997 than you can do now, right? And then he started cashing in on rising house prices by introducing upper bands. And at this point, stamp duty was this weird slab style system. So once you went through a threshold, you paid that higher amount above that threshold on the entire purchase price, right? And this was fine, roughly up until the credit crunch we were talking about earlier, because the housing market was just going up. House prices were just going up. People were remortgaging homes and pulling money out. People were taking out interest-only mortgages with no idea of how they were going to pay them back. And nobody was worried. Music was playing. People were dancing. And then all of a sudden, that stopped. And stamp duty became a problem. And then George Osborne decided to cash in a bit more on stamp duty. Then he decided to reform stamp duty to make it a normal style threshold tax, like income tax. So you pay a certain amount up to a threshold and then a certain amount more above it. But because he didn't want to be seen to be favouring rich people, we've made so many bad decisions in this country on tax over the last 20 years because people were terrified of being seen to be favouring rich people. So they introduced bad taxes or bad elements of taxes off the back of it, right? He made it really expensive at the upper end. Then he also introduced the 3% surcharge to affect second home buyers and buy-to-let landlords. And you just got to this point where it just kind of ratcheted it up to be this tax that is even worse than it was. It stops people moving for work, economic benefit from that. It stops people buying homes. You don't get the economic effect of that. And when people move home, as Ang said, they buy stuff. They buy furniture, they buy white goods, they pay for decorators, they do renovations, they do all this kind of stuff. Economists are widely in agreement that stamp duty is a really bad tax. But the best time to get rid of it is when you're not making any money from it. And that was the huge mistake that Rishi Sunak made. Literally, stamp duty revenues had fallen to almost nothing at that point because the property market had been frozen in that early bit of lockdown. Right? You couldn't view homes, you couldn't send a surveyor around a home, you couldn't do all of these things. And then when it reopened, Rishi Sunak announced his stamp duty holiday a few months later in order to get things going. And getting rid of stamp duty is a good idea. Stamp duty holidays are a terrible idea because they create this window when people rush. And we've got a wonderful chart in our story about stamp duty that shows this amazing spike, you know, as people rush to do it and they pay higher prices. But if you just got rid of it, you wouldn't have that same rush. Arguably, you'd need to replace it with something. We're not exactly flush with cash at the moment. But there were some figures, Institute of Economic Affairs, which said this was the single best reform any government could make to Britain's tax system, reckoned that we'd get 3/4 of the lost revenue back by removing the wider social and economic harms that stamp duty causes. Obviously, that's a bit back of the fag packet. But I think arguably this would be a good idea.
Ang, what do you reckon? The Labour Party might steal a march on the Tories on this one and borrow that idea?
Absolutely no chance. Well, they'd have to listen to economists for a start, which they don't seem to have been doing for the last year. But I think also, you know, the idea that it would, if we scrapped stamp duty, it would benefit the rich in more expensive homes. I think they would just avoid that at all costs. They've really distanced themselves from a wealth tax. I just don't see it happening. I think they'll blame it on cost. But actually, I think, you know, if you scrap it, you kind of need a reform of property. They probably have to look at council tax, you know, replace stamp duty. They probably end up replacing stamp duty with higher taxes on owners of more expensive homes. So I think it's something that they don't want to touch because it becomes, as Simon says, it becomes too complicated. I think that it, optics wise, I think that they will avoid it.
Finally, Ang, energy prices went up again at the start of this month, but some people paid nothing for their energy last weekend. Who are these people? What is this about?
Yeah, so during Storm Amy last weekend, wind generation, I think it was 50% of electricity was wind. So it basically meant that the renewable supply onto the grid outstripped demand. So that in turn turned energy prices negative for the full day. So that was the first time it had happened in 2 years, which is great. Sounds great. But it wasn't that useful for, you know, the normal consumer that is either on a fixed tariff, suppliers have already hedged and bought that energy, did it months ago, or even those on that haven't fixed and are on a variable tariff, they're, you know, they're stuck on the price cap because that's already been set. But there are some savvier households, usually people with electric vehicles, or as one energy supplier that I spoke to said, energy nerds, that are on tariffs, agile tariffs. So there's Oxford Energy have got one. They essentially track the wholesale market sort of a day behind. So the idea of these tariffs is basically to shift your usage for, you know, things like laundry, dishwashing, that sort of thing, to outside of peak times. In theory, you get a lower rate. So for people that were tracking their energy and saw that prices were going negative, they were actually getting paid to use their energy because prices were minus 3p or something like that. So it's great for those people. I mean, it's such a tiny minority. I think in theory, we'll probably get to a point where we'll all move on to these sort of tariffs because the national grid is very outdated. We need to get to a situation where, you know, not everyone is kind of doing everything at 4 p.m. till 7 p.m. and that sort of thing. It's going to take a while. I think that the most frustrating thing when I was writing this story is I thought it's probably quite a basic question is, well, can't we just save some of that energy, some of that negative energy, and then just use it at a later date? And actually, it costs billions to do that because essentially the power lines that we use are so outdated. There aren't enough of them to get them that energy from Scotland down to London or wherever. And we just do not have the infrastructure to deal with it. So some people really benefited from it, but the rest of us won't.
All right then, Simon.
Stat of the week. £17. That is the smallest premium bond holding ever to land the £1 million jackpot. It was in July 2004 by a saver based in Newham, East London. And this statistic comes from our fantastic Do You Have What It Takes to Be a Premium Bonds Millionaire piece that our reporter Helen Graham wrote for us this week, where we've got some exclusive data from NS&I on the £1 million winners going back 31 years. And we have analysed the past 378 premium bond prize draws and 564 millionaires to see who won with the smallest amount, who had to wait the longest, how much they had to hold, and so on. And you can go and look up how many people have won near you. So go to thisismoney.co.uk/saving to find that one.
All right, Simon, thank you, and thank you, and thank you for listening. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. And if you're an energy nerd, this week we want to hear from energy nerds. Are you one of those people who basically isn't paying anything for your electricity? You've got solar panels, you've got batteries, you've got an electric car. You are absolutely nerding out on electricity in a way that Ed Miliband could only dream of. If that's you, email us at podcast@thisismoney.co.uk. Ang wants to hear from you. And come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join the debate and read the comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.